living creatures on the hither side of good and evil. In human beings it was visible only when they were in repose, their minds untroubled, their bodies motionless. In these circumstances, Vermeer could see suchness in all its heavenly beauty, could see and in some small measure render it in a subtle and sumptuous still life. Vermeer is undoubtedly the greatest painter of human still lives. But there have been others, for example, Vermeer's French contemporaries, the Lenain brothers. They set out, I suppose, to be genre painters, but what they actually produced was a series of human still lives, in which their cleansed perception of the infinite significance of all things is rendered not as with Vermeer by subtle enrichment of color and texture, but by a heightened clarity and obsessive distinctness of form within an austere, almost monochromatic tonality. In our own day, we have had Vuillard, the painter at his best of unforgettably splendid pictures of the Dharma body manifested in a bourgeois bedroom, of the absolute blazing away in the midst of some stockbroker's family in a suburban garden taking tea. Ce qui fait que l'ancien bandagiste renie le comptoir dont le faste allait chez les passants, c'est son jardin d'Auteuil, où, veuf de tout enceint, les zinnias ont l'air d'être en tôle vernis. For Laurent Taillade, the spectacle was merely obscene. But if the retired rubber goods merchant had sat still enough, Vuillard would have seen in him only the Dharma body, would have painted in the zinnias the goldfish pool, the villa's Moorish tower and Chinese lanterns, a corner of Eden before the fall. But meanwhile my question remained unanswered. How was this cleansed perception to be reconciled with a proper concern with human relations, with the necessary chores and duties, to say nothing of charity and practical compassion? The age-old debate between the actives and the contemplatives was being renewed, so far as I was concerned, with an unprecedented poignancy. For until this morning I had known contemplation only in its humbler, its more ordinary forms, as discursive thinking, as a rapt absorption in poetry or painting or music, as a patient waiting upon those inspirations without which even the prosiest writer cannot hope to accomplish anything, as occasional glimpses in nature of Wordsworth's something far more deeply interfused, as systematic silence leading sometimes to hints of an obscure knowledge. But now I knew contemplation at its height. At its height, but not yet in its fullness. For in its fullness the way of Mary includes the way of Martha, and raises it, so to speak, to its own higher power. Mescaline opens up the way of Mary, but shuts the door on that of Martha. It gives access to contemplation, but to a contemplation that is incompatible with action, and even with the will to action, the very thought of action. In the intervals between his revelations, the mescaline taker is apt to feel that though in one way everything is supremely as it should be, in another there is something wrong. His problem is essentially the same as that which confronts the quietist, the arhat, and on another level, the landscape painter, and the painter of human still lives. Mescaline can never solve that problem. It can only pose it, apocalyptically, for those to whom it had never before presented itself. The full and final solution can be found only by those who are prepared to implement the right kind of Weltanschauung by means of the right kind of behavior and the right kind of constant and unstrained alertness. Over against the quietist stands the active contemplative, the saint, the man who, in Eckhart's phrase, is ready to come down from the seventh heaven in order to bring a cup of water to his sick brother. Over against the Arhat, retreating from appearances into an entirely transcendental nirvana, stands the Bodhisattva, for whom suchness and the world of contingencies are one, and for whose boundless compassion every one of those contingencies is an occasion not only for transfiguring insight, but also for the most practical charity. And in the universe of art, over against Vermeer and the other painters of human still lives, over against the masters of Chinese and Japanese landscape painting, over against Constable and Turner, against Sisley and Seurat and Cézanne, stands the all-inclusive art of Rembrandt. These are enormous names, inaccessible eminences. For myself, on this memorable May morning, I could only be grateful for an experience which had shown me, more clearly than I had ever seen it before, the true nature of the challenge and the completely liberating response. Let me add, before we leave this subject, that there is no form of contemplation, even the most quietistic, which is without its ethical values. Half at least of all morality is negative, and consists in keeping out of mischief. The Lord's Prayer is less than 50 words long, and 6 of those words are devoted to asking God not to lead us into temptation. The one-sided contemplative leaves undone many things that he ought to do, but to make up for it, he refrains from doing a host of things he ought not to do. The sum of evil, Pascal remarked, would be much diminished if men could only learn to sit quietly in their rooms. The contemplative, whose perception has been cleansed, does not have to stay in his room. He can go about his business, so completely satisfied to see and be a part of the divine order of things, that he will never even be tempted to indulge in what Traherne called the dirty devices of the world. When we feel ourselves to be sole heirs of the universe, when the sea flows in our veins and the stars are our jewels, when all things are perceived as infinite and holy, what motive can we have for covetousness or self-assertion, for the pursuit of power or the drearier forms of pleasure? Contemplatives are not likely to become gamblers or procurers or drunkards. They do not, as a rule, preach intolerance or make war, do not find it necessary to rob, swindle, or grind the faces of the poor. And to these enormous negative virtues, we may add another which, though hard to define, is both positive and important. The Arhat and the quietist may not practice contemplation in its fullness, but if they practice it at all, they may bring back enlightening reports of another, a transcendent country of the mind. And if they practice it in the height, they will become conduits through which some beneficent influence can flow out of that other country into a world of darkened selves, chronically dying for lack of it. Meanwhile, I had turned, at the investigator's request, from the portrait of Cézanne to what was going on inside my head when I shut my eyes. This time, the inscape was curiously unrewarding. The field of vision was filled with brightly colored, constantly changing structures that seemed to be made of plastic or enameled tin. Cheap, I commented. Trivial, like things in a 5 and 10. And all this shoddiness existed in a closed, cramped universe. It's as though one were below decks in a ship, I said. A 5 and 10 cent ship. And as I looked, it became very clear that this 5 and 10 cent ship was in some way connected with human pretensions, with the portrait of Cézanne, with A.B. among the Dolomites overacting his favorite character in fiction. This suffocating interior of a dime store ship was my own personal self. These gimcrack mobiles of tin and plastic were my personal contributions to the universe. I felt the lesson to be salutary, but was sorry nonetheless that it had had to be administered at this moment and in this form. As a rule, the mescaline taker discovers an inner world as manifestly a datum, as self-evidently infinite and holy, as that transfigured outer world which I had seen with my eyes open. From the first, my own case had been different. Mescaline had endowed me temporarily with the power to see things with my eyes shut, but it could not, or at least on this occasion did not, reveal an inscape remotely comparable to my flowers or chair or flannels out there. What it had allowed me to perceive inside was not the Dharma body in images, but my own mind. Not suchness, but a set of symbols. In other words, a homemade substitute for suchness. Most visualizers are transformed by mescaline into visionaries. Some of them, and they are perhaps more numerous than is generally supposed, require no transformation. They are visionaries all the time. The mental species to which Blake belonged is fairly widely distributed even in the urban industrial societies of the present day. The poet-artist's uniqueness does not consist in the fact that, to quote from his descriptive catalogue, he actually saw those wonderful originals called in the sacred scriptures the cherubim. It does not consist in the fact that these wonderful originals seen in my visions were some of them 100 feet in height, all containing mythological and recondite meaning. It consists solely in his ability to render, in words or somewhat less successfully in line and color, some hint at least of a not excessively uncommon experience. The untalented visionary may perceive an inner reality no less tremendous, beautiful, and significant than the world beheld by Blake, but he lacks altogether the ability to express, in literary or plastic symbols, what he has seen. From the records of religion and the surviving monuments of poetry and the plastic arts, it is very plain that at most times and in most places, men have attached more importance to the inscape than to objective existence, have felt that what they saw with their eyes shut possessed a spiritually higher significance than what they saw with their eyes open. The reason? Familiarity breeds contempt, and how to survive is a problem ranging in urgency from the chronically tedious to the excruciating. The outer world is what we wake up to every morning of our lives, is the place where, willy-nilly, we must try to make our living. In the inner world there is neither work nor monotony. We visit it only in dreams and musings, and its strangeness is such that we never find the same world on 2 successive occasions. What wonder, then, if human beings